Welcome to the Table Podcast, where we discuss issues of God and culture, brought to you by Dallas Theological Seminary.
Welcome to the Table. We discuss issues of God and culture. I'm Daryl Bach, Executive Director of Cultural Engagement at the Hendrick Center at Dallas Theological Seminary in Dallas, Texas. And our topic today is Hispanics in the Church. And I have three distinguished guests with me today, Yvonne Leon, Miguel Lopez, and Michael Ortiz. And I'm going to let them each introduce themselves and their ministries. And I'm going to start here with Yvonne. Tell us a little bit about what you do and where you live and your association with Hispanic ministry.
Well, Dr. Buck, it's a pleasure to be here. Mm-hmm. And also, I'm glad to talk to your audience. I am Yvonne Leon, as you said. I was born originally in Argentina, mm-hmm. came here to the U.S. 20 years ago. My passion always been to utilize media, this form of communication, in fact, to reach Latinos. Mm-hmm. And I came to the U.S. precisely to get training in that. I got a bachelor's at Dallas Liberty University. Uh-huh. And that's the technical side of my training. And then I was fortunate to come to here, DTS, and get my theological training. Mm-hmm. And so those two areas complement, and I now lead a marketing agency that is dedicated to help ministries, churches, publishers really engage the untapped Hispanic population in the U.S.
Okay. Thanks, Juan. And Miguel?
Thank you, Dr. Bach. Mm-hmm. I'm so excited to be here today. Mm-hmm. I'm one of the pastors at the Heights Baptist Church, teaching pastor for the church and also responsible for our Hispanic ministry.
And that's here. Is it in Dallas or in a suburb of Dallas?
Yes, it is in Richardson, okay. A suburb of Dallas. Uh-huh. And, our ministry approach is an integrated ministry, which basically means that we're not a church inside of a church. We mm-hmm. are a ministry that seeks to create a cultural bridge between the Hispanic community and the vibrant life of the local church. So everybody that's part of this Hispanic ministry are members of the Heights, and they get to participate in every ministry and also join the mission of the church.
Okay, and Michael?
Dr. Bach, thank you again for having us at this table podcast. It's an honor to be here with you. My name is Michael Ortiz, and I'm currently working at Dallas Theological Seminary. I have a faculty administrative role. My faculty role is working in the teaching in the World Missions Intercultural Studies Department, but I'm also working as director of what now is DTS in Español, which I'm sure we'll hear more about that. But in essence, it's part of a new department here at DTS, intending to try to reach out to the Hispanic culture and have programs and courses and other initiatives that will hopefully bridge that gap between theological education and the local Hispanic church.
Okay. Now, I've heard two terms that I kind of want to unpack before we even get started to show you how basic this conversation is, and that is you hear the word Hispanic, and it sounds like it's all one thing. Okay, or you hear the word Latino, and it sounds like it's all one thing, okay? But I have someone from Argentina here, right? Mm-hmm. And Miguel, where are your family roots from originally?
From Mexico originally.
From Mexico. Mm-hmm. And Michael, where are your family roots originally?
From Cuba.
Okay, so that already introduces the point of the question. Yep. So let's talk about terminology here to start off, and just to throw everybody off at the start, you know. let's talk about Hispanic and Latino. Here's the question. Are those the better terms to use in describing the group? And then what do you need to be aware of as you describe this group? And Miguel, I think I'm going to start with you.
Sure. Okay. Well, the label, of course, is a label that's pretty much a label used in the United States.
Okay.
When you talk about Latinos or Hispanics, you're trying to address a very diverse people group that mm-hmm. The term tries to describe cultural realities, mm-hmm. but also countries of origin and precedence. Mm-hmm. So it is Hispanics are not a monolithic group. Mm-hmm. You have mm-hmm. nationalities like Cubans, Mexicans, right? People from all over the world. Mm-hmm. So you can see that they are not monolithic in that sense, but also culturally. Mm-hmm. When you talk about Hispanics, you may be referring to somebody that's just a first generation immigrant mm-hmm. whose first language is Spanish, but that learned English here or may not have learned English. And then you have their children that grow up here, a second generation that whose primary language is English, and then they still speak some Spanish. And then you will have some Hispanics that if we're thinking more on a racial tone, all Hispanics are mestizos. They're a mix, right, of European mm-hmm. cultures and then a native culture. So you have third generation Hispanics that speak only English and maybe have a Spanish name or some cultural makeup, but they're not a lot anything that their first generation grandparents would be. So you have a very diverse group in culture or ethnicity or country of origin in that label. Mm-hmm. Finding the right label is difficult, but I think in general it encompasses all those cultures that have to do with that ancestry.
Okay, Ivan, you have anything you want to add to that? And then I'm going to ask you about Brazilians in a second. So,
thanks very much.
Obviously to the Argentinians.
Yeah, right.
Well, no, diversity obviously is very clear as, Miguel here described it. But one aspect that I'd always like to notice is that, you know, especially those that arrive here from those Latin countries, once they're here, really their nationality boundaries begin to kind of blur. You know, mm-hmm. I have more Mexican, you know, connections now or Colombian or Cuban than I ever had. And mm-hmm. in my daily life, I experience those cultures as well. And I'm basically a Hispanic like my fellow neighbor, right? Mm-hmm. And so except other than for every 4 years when the World Cup comes around. I think there is a sense also of, you know, community uh-huh. because we're all here as immigrants. Uh-huh. And even those that are already born here, mm-hmm. but by the way, the majority of Hispanics in the U.S. are already
now,
born
I'm gonna
here. I'm going
to come talk okay? about that in a minute.
But there are still, you know, family traditions, aspirations, attitudes that really tie to that heritage and make it rich. And so, they still feel that sense of pride in that identity. So my point is, it's diverse, but in that diversity, I think there's unity as well.
Okay. And so what do you do with the Brazilians? are they in the family or are they cousins, or how do you think about Brazilians?
It's an interesting question. Why don't I let the Cuban answer?
That's a good idea. Thank you. So
Michael, I mean, obviously, if you do DTS in Espanol, that's not Portuguese, but still. I raised the question to almost illustrate the difficulty.
Yeah, you know, I think the term Latino, as some would say, that Latino refers to anyone that is from the Latin American setting or background. So you could almost take Latino and you could include the Brazilians in there if you wanted to, uh-huh. If you look at it from that perspective. The term Hispanic may then be a broader term in the sense that it might cover Spanish speakers that may not be from Latin America, may not be living in the United States, but in other parts of the world, including Spain and other sections of the world. So the way I see it is Hispanic is probably a broader term, and maybe Latino is one that has its roots has to do with a geographical location. So
then what do we do with the Spaniards?
Well, you know, that's
welcome that love and Christian love. That's
I think it goes back to my point. Uh-huh. They're brothers. Uh-huh. You know, I mean, they're really brothers, siblings. They're part of the family. Uh-huh. Spanish, Portuguese, is, you know, almost speaks is similar in sounding, and we can understand. But I think, again, you know, once they're here. Other than in the World Cup, you know, we feel a lot of unity and affinity. We want to get together, you know, to socialize, because basically we share a lot of those common traditions.
Okay. Now, the next question is, I think, an obvious one coming off of this, and that is, there are cultural features and cultural affinities that exist out of this cultural context. Let's talk about some of the values that would be identified with being Hispanic or Latino that are a part of the world that many Hispanics live in. And I don't know who to have begin here. Maybe Yvonne, why don't you start us off on that one? What values do you see as important to to Hispanics in general. And again, it's a generalization, but I do think there are some characteristics that people recognize.
Yeah, well, definitely, you know, when I'm going to speak more of those that come from other countries, mm-hmm. or they have over the last, you know, 2-3 decades, you know, they brought a lot of energy and mm-hmm. dedication and entrepreneurship. I mean, Hispanic entrepreneurial business are skyrocketing right now in this mm-hmm. economy. And so the reason is because, you know, they bring all the energy, mm-hmm. the really hard work ethic, mm-hmm. you know, infused into the society. I think it's the way to really get into this cultural and to move up the social ladder and so on. So I think that aspect, you know, is very important. Another aspect is actually religion, mm-hmm. you know, and mainline denominations in the U.S. mm-hmm. are surviving and are actually moving and growing because of the influence of ethnicities and mm-hmm. specifically Hispanics. And so there's a big movement in that. A lot of them arrive with Catholic roots, we mentioned before, mm-hmm. But they're moving away from that tradition mm-hmm. In search for a more genuine mm-hmm. and fresh and actually, you know, part of their acculturation to the society. So I think those two are really, really key.
Okay. Miguel, you think of anything else that belongs in that mix?
You know, I think it also, a strong sense of relationships. Mm-hmm. It's not so much the pragmatic, task-oriented mentality.
Right.
It is very much a relational social fabric that mm-hmm. moves the Hispanic community. In Latin America, it's all about relationships, and mm-hmm. and the proverbial mañana is not that people don't care about tasks, it's right. that relationship takes priority over that. So family also, your extended relationships matter a little bit more than mm-hmm. for the average American family, because your geography, your job, and your occupations isn't very much, in a big degree, determined by your proximity to your loved ones. So mm-hmm. familism to an extent is a predominant value. And as Ivan said, I would second that. Spirituality is very important, not necessarily just religion, but just spirituality. Mm-hmm. Hispanics have a sense of destiny and the mm-hmm. supernatural mm-hmm. that sometimes is not satisfied by religion mm-hmm. and therefore gets people in trouble with syncretism or mm-hmm. spirituality that's not necessarily distinctively Christian or mm-hmm. even in the ballpark.
Well, that's an interesting observation. I may come back to that. Michael, you have anything you want to add to the mix? I was thinking actually family was one of the things that was in my head as I was asking the question, because mm-hmm. I've seen Hispanic family. One of my closest friends is half Guatemalan and had a Guatemalan mother, and their family was always around them. When I was with them, I wasn't just with brothers and sisters. I was with cousins and mm-hmm. grandparents and that kind of thing.
Yeah, obviously, family is very important in the Hispanic culture. I know that in Cuba, for instance, it's not uncommon. I'm talking about the Cuban setting, but even here in the United States, I just met with someone here in Florida a couple of days ago who they're from Cuba, but they lived in New Jersey for a long time. And I asked them what part of New Jersey, because I know that there's a section in Jersey where most of the Cubans would live, and they seem to kind of come together and settle in a certain area, and then they make that sort of their home for a long time. The other comment I wanted to make concerning the family is that what I also see that is maybe not unique necessarily, but it stands out a little bit more, I think, within the Hispanic family and the culture, and that is especially when you see the first generation Hispanics come to the U.S., the parents really are here not so much for themselves, of course, but also they have children. They really want to see their children advance and mm-hmm. get education and have a better life here. And you see that across the board, I think, with most Hispanics. You'll have parents that are working several jobs just to have their children be able to have the right education, go to the right schools and advance, so that they have a better, more opportunities here than they would have had in their native country.
Now let's talk about something that I think, Yvonne, you raised, which is most of the Hispanics who are here are second or third generation. They're mm-hmm. they haven't immigrated here. Mm-hmm. Now I know you were ready with some statistics earlier, and but in general, what are we talking about? I mean, is this 2/3, 1/3? You know, what kind of a breakdown are we talking about here?
About 55% of the 57 million. Uh-huh. already were born here.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what the Barna research.
And the Hispanic population in the United States now represents what percent of the total? Do you know that? Do you have that
of the total U.S.?
Yeah.
Yeah, 16%. 16%. 17%.
Okay. So it's so I suspect it comprises now the largest minority.
It is the largest. Yes, it is the largest minority. It was also the fastest minority up until
fastest growing.
Fastest growing. Yeah, uh-huh. Fastest growing. It has slowed down a little bit. Uh-huh. I guess people are now taking more cautious. All right. But still projected to be the largest minority by 2015.
Okay.
I mean, 2050. I'm sorry, 2050.
Okay. Yeah.
So it's still a really large pool of people uh-huh. with their own, identities and attitudes and all of that.
Right, right. And of course, the other reality that sits behind this is that when you add all the minorities that are here together, I don't know what year it's supposed to happen, but sometime in the next couple of three decades, mm-hmm. The United States is supposed to become the Anglo presence will become a minority,
yeah.
and the conglomeration of others will become the majority in mm-hmm. our own national population, which shows how much our country is changing and raises the issue of why this conversation is so important.
Absolutely.
So, Michael, since you have a responsibility here at the seminary for thinking about this, tell me how you view this change that we're in the midst of.
Well, I think that the statistics are certainly there, and what we're trying to do with DTS in Espanol is really to try to understand what is happening in the Hispanic culture, particularly with the local church, and what is our role in terms of theological education and providing training for the church, for congregants, for other Hispanics that might be looking for theological education. We have the first generations folks that are here, and for the most part for them, they speak solely Spanish or primarily Spanish. But then you have the second and third generation that are here, and they're wanting to shift more towards the English. And so we're trying to think through where do we really invest in as a seminary to make sure that we are offering the courses, the training, the programs that most Spanish speakers will need, depending on what their primary language is and what they want to do.
Now, I don't think I asked this earlier, but what percentage of the Hispanic population that's here is predominantly primary or exclusively Spanish speaking? Does anyone know what those numbers would look like?
Yes, I actually it's kind of, I wouldn't say in millions, I would think that it's probably kind of split at mm-hmm. this point because of what I just said, that mm-hmm. The majority of them already were born here,
mm-hmm.
and so they are already speaking English, and mm-hmm. they're speaking some Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
Now the others have arrived,
mm-hmm.
and they obviously bring Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
They are learning English as they can. Some of them never do.
Mm-hmm.
So this is something that marketers, communicators really looked into very deeply
mm-hmm.
To figure out what is the best way to create communication messages, whether it's advertisement or positioning or anything. So it is a science, and it is an art in mm-hmm. that aspect as well.
Mm-hmm. So I guess part of I think the figure that I have heard now, I don't want to get into the immigration discussion with this question, but is that the amount of supposed I don't know whether I've heard the number around 11 million. I don't know whether that is an undocumented number or the number of immigrants per se.
The number is being thrown as the number of undocumented immigrants.
Okay, so and obviously most of those people come in, and they come in with Spanish, certainly primarily.
Definitely.
Okay, so but on top of that, we've got many Hispanics who are bilingual. Okay, yeah. Second and third generation, et cetera. And then we've got some people who've been here a while who've learned English, etc. So that number may be high in terms of the totality of people who are Spanish only. And the reason I raise this is I was actually going to begin this broadcast by speaking what little Spanish I know and saying buenos dias to you guys and como estas. Yeah, buenas tardes, exactly. And it's not quite buenas noches yet. Right. And so... And to make a linguistic point, and that is that one of the challenges in the churches here in the United States for thinking about how you minister to this community is wrestling with the question, like we have already on campus, about, all right, do you do this in English only, or do you think about, if it's an out effort to reach out, do you do it, do you have some Spanish only stuff, or do you provide for translation? Those kinds of questions. Now, Miguel, my question for you is, you work in a church that's trying to sort this out. How do you handle that question?
It's a great question. Well, there are lots of models that can be implemented, whether it's simultaneous translation with technology, or sometimes there are preachers that preach in Spanish and in English just taking turns. There are many, many methodologies, and many of them seem to be effective. I don't think the method matters is the most important thing as much as how it gets implemented and the support that it gets from the whole community for the church. In our particular case, we do have a Spanish speaking service because many of the people in the community that we're trying to reach speak primarily Spanish and will not be learning English for many reasons, or they prefer Spanish. So we do have a worship service in Spanish that happens at the same time as the English service. And our children and those who are bilingual are able to participate in any ministry of the church for the other ministries. So it works for us to have a Spanish service. We have the facilities, we have the resources to make it happen. For other people that want to communicate in a different way, a translated service might work, or a bilingual service. It's not, the methodology is not the defining element, I believe. It is the ethos of the church and how they get perceived and accepted that counts the most, because it's all about relationship.
Interesting. Now, we got about a minute and a half, so this is a quick question for you, Michael. How's the seminary handling this? Are we doing any Spanish-speaking classes exclusively, or is everything that we do in English?
No, right now we're doing everything in Spanish. Even the literature that we are requiring the students to read and use for the courses, that will all be in Spanish. The professors will be teaching in Spanish. The interaction between the students and between the students, the professor, that will all be in Spanish. Now, our courses right now are online. We may move to some hybrid courses, and eventually we may even have courses on campus. But we made the decision early on that we were going to focus on the Spanish language and use that as our primary language to communicate and learn in and to teach.
Tell me what I, as an Anglo, don't get about being Hispanic or Latino. What is it, if you had a chance to say something to me about how to think about understanding or relating to a culture that I'm not a part of, what would you tell me? What advice would you give? And Yvonne, I think I'll start with you in terms of answering that.
Yes, this is a question that we try to answer to all our clients in our firm. I mean, we work with large ministries, publishers.
What's the name of your organization?
It's called Kerux Group. Kerux Group comes from a Greek, not Hispanic.
Yeah.
But it means herald, and it means a voice. And we want to be a voice for all these organizations, the Anglos, into the Hispanic community. So keruxgroup.com, K-E-R-U-X group.com. They can go there and find information about us. But that's what we try to do, to really open the eyes to the Anglo entities, and you know how a Hispanic thinks, what's the way they communicate, what is the expectations also as their audience. So you know, one of the things I would say in terms of trying to understand the audience is that Hispanics are, you know, very visual, very colorful, very emotional, and all those aspects need to be included in your communication approach. You know, they can really spot something that is done not professionally with shortcuts. You know, when translations are done halfway, we can really identify that. And it goes to the heart of credibility. Mm-hmm. And when we're dealing with the message, the gospel, it is really key that that is removed if you want to reach people really truly in an authentic way. Mm-hmm. So that's what we do. And that will be my advice, not to try to shortcut. The fact that somebody in your church or in your organization speaks Spanish and, you know, can do some translation does not mean it's going to really connect with the audience that you're after, because there is an art and there is a science to it.
Miguel?
You know, there are two things that I think, mm-hmm. agreeing with Ivan also about that, taking a step further, two things that I would want you to understand as an Anglo about mm-hmm. a Hispanic person. Mm-hmm. The first one is that being a Hispanic person, as some theologians have said, is kind of living in the hyphen. Mm-hmm. It's living in transition between cultures. It's being in a journey that we haven't mm-hmm. quite arrived. And for somebody that belongs to a particular context, this journey may not make a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like the Israelites getting out of Egypt and going to the Promised Land. Well, it takes them 40 years, and that generation doesn't make it. Well, that journey of the 4 years is the becoming. Mm-hmm. It is living in that hyphen. So that's one thing. The other thing is that Latin Americans, Hispanics, Latinos are mestizo people, mm-hmm. which means they're a contradiction of cultures put together in unity.
They're already a mix.
Absolutely.
So they're a hyphen and a hyphen.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But not only that, the culture is not one of compartmentalization where everything is neat and tight, and it is a flow mm-hmm. of relationship. Mm-hmm. So some of the things that don't make sense from Hispanics, many times for Anglos, mm-hmm. come from the fact that, for instance, the mañana or the viva la vida, the enjoying life, right? Uh-huh. It's not that people are lazy or don't have a good work ethic. There are values mm-hmm. that may be driving this journey, mm-hmm. and there are some things that are more important than others that mm-hmm. you don't necessarily share.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I'll give you one that comes up right away the moment I go to Latin America. It's called tiempo.
That's
time.
Right.
And the handling of time. How does talk a little bit about that.
Well, it's all about relationship mm-hmm. again. Being timely and getting things done is important, but not nearly as important as relationship and how you get it done.
Mm-hmm.
So starting and finishing a particular appointment is all a function of the person you're meeting or the kind of things you want to get accomplished. It is more important for me to end up my meeting well with you, mm-hmm. however long that takes, mm-hmm. than to close a deal.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a different set of values. And mm-hmm. People matter.
So running long or starting late, if it's in a context in which relationships are being built, et cetera, that's not that big a deal.
It is a big deal, but yeah. not as big as a deal as making a good impression or being respected by that people.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Michael, what do you have to add to this mix?
I think what they've said most of it. I would just concur with Miguel, too, in the sense that relationship building, you know, when I go into a Spanish setting or Hispanic church, it's a very different setting than a non-Hispanic church, in the sense that people, when they ask you how are you doing, they really are asking you how are you doing.
Yeah, yeah. It's not a form of greeting.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And they want to enter into a discussion with you. They want to learn about you. They want to learn about your family. And not just here in the U.S., but when I travel overseas and in Latin America, Cuba, other locations where there's mostly Hispanics in those locations, they will always ask me, how is your family? How are your children? And they really do mean it, and they want to spend time understanding how are things going for you, and that's it does force things to slow down a little bit,
mm-hmm.
but you need to allow enough if you're going to interact with Hispanics, you need to allow enough margin to be able to enter into those dialogues with them, because they really want to know.
Okay, now this transitions into a question that's going to kind of have two segments to it. One, the first is let's think about the space that you create in your communities for Hispanics, and the importance on the one hand of having them feel accepted and be assimilated versus the tension of allowing them to be Hispanics at the same time, if I can pose it that way. It may not even be the best way to pose the question, but I think you know what I'm getting at, that oftentimes in communities there's this tension between, and particularly if you have oversight over a community, how much do we try and homogenize everything and make everything the same? And how much do we respect the fact that different groups, in part because of their differences, need to have some space to be who they also are, rather than to impose the the majority culture on them. Help us negotiate that question. And what I have in mind here in the backdrop is a church that's saying, you know, we recognize that we've got Hispanics living around us in our neighborhood. We'd like to reach out and figure out a way to do this. What are some of the do's and don'ts in that in relationship to the question that I'm asking? Michael, how would you get started on that?
I think that, first of all, I think we've covered a little bit of it already in the sense that the Hispanic culture is not monocultural.
Mm-hmm.
And so as a pastor or someone that wants to minister to Hispanics here in the U.S., you need to be aware of who your audience really is, who the members are in that setting. They could be from various different countries that would bring with them different attitudes, even different terminology sometimes. I've been in settings where I'll use a certain term, thinking that it's perfectly a perfectly fine term to use, and people are laughing at me, and I'm wondering why. So we need to be careful with that. And just be able to really begin to listen to what are their needs, where are they wanting to go. The other aspect to keep in mind too is that we need to be thinking about the influence of the globalization movement, even in local settings. You have parents that might not have as much of that influence in their lives, but they have their children and others that they're interacting with that are starting to understand that there's a world even outside their immediate setting, and how is that influencing them as well? So it's a complex issue, I think, but I think it starts with trying to understand and listen carefully.
Yvonne?
Yeah, I would say to somebody who is thinking about how to do Hispanic ministry, don't be timid. Don't be timid. I mean, one common denominator that I observe in a lot of organizations is that, you know, they think that, okay, we have Hispanics here, so let's try to do something in a, you know, almost like an experimental way. And I mean, like I said, Hispanics would spot that as a really lack of authenticity, care, interest. I mean, the brands, corporations understand that, and they're making big investments and long-term commitments because they see that, you know, in 3 decades, this is where, you know, the major audience is going to be of, you know, the brand. So I think ministries need to be really serious about this if they're going to enter. You know, of course, there are ways to mitigate risk and to be good stewards of, you know, the resources the Lord gives. But it goes to the attitude, right? Mm-hmm. It goes, you got to show the same passion that you show for your youth ministry or for, you know, your men's ministry to Hispanic ministry.
Miguel?
I think there are 3 things that we need to consider when we go into Hispanic ministries or churches, and churches are uniquely equipped to address this need. The first one has to do with replacing assimilation with integration. Mm-hmm. Assimilation is the world's cookie-cutter mechanism to bring people into the melting pot.
Mm-hmm.
I think the church is better than that. The church has a chance to bring all of God's people into the full participation of God's purposes. That's integration.
Mm-hmm.
As we partner together to do the mission of God and dignify people in their context, we can experience unity and diversity. So integration. How do we make that happen? Incarnation.
Mm-hmm.
Christ offers the perfect model, being God himself and becoming human, to bridge the biggest possible gap of cultures, if you will, God's culture and human culture. And he doesn't appear, he doesn't just go and do some benevolence ministry, he becomes. So incarnation, the third one, has to do with mutuality.
Mm-hmm.
When you pile your leadership resources and welcome people and dignify them, you bring them to be equal partners. It's not the church that meets at 6 p.m. It's not the second class member of a church. It is a brother or sister in Christ. So we effectively create a third culture. I'm no longer Jew or Gentile, I'm a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a platform from which every ministry can grow and prosper.
Now, that makes an observation that I think reflects what sometimes can be a blind spot. This is actually true of all intercultural interactions. And that's almost a kind of a patronizing that can take place that even in some cases might not even be intended, but exists. So I want you to talk a little bit about that. What can come across as patronizing, even though it might be well-intended, that actually ends up, in some cases, doing more harm or creating more distance than good?
Well, there's a lot of that. Well, for instance, paternalism in churches. When well-intended churches want to plant a Hispanic church and they want to pile all the resources and dictate how every ministry should be led, and they always want to control every single aspect of the new church plant because obviously they don't know any better. It might be well-intended for the church to grow and bring best practices, but they don't give an equal partnership level to those who they are trying to help. Or just some well-intended questions, as you said, when people sometimes ask me, so you're Hispanic, that means you're not white, right? When we make racial categories and we don't understand that Hispanic is not a racial term, it's a cultural one. So things like that sometimes create tensions that are unnecessary.
Michael, you have anything to add to that mix in terms of what can be brought forward?
Sure. I mean, I think when I'm thinking about theological education, because that's where I'm mostly involved with right now in terms of the Hispanic culture, it's really being able to understand and enter into a dialogue with them about what is it that you really need? What are some of the areas that you need training in? What are some of the areas that you want to improve upon in terms of your understanding of theology and Bible? And try to address those needs, as opposed to going into that culture or that setting and presuming that you have the answers that they are looking for, and you might have the answers to the wrong questions. So, you know, I think that that's something to be keeping in mind as well. We often want to approach and be cross-cultural and enter into different settings, different worlds, but sometimes we are eager to do so, but we're not listening very carefully. So.
Okay, I want to follow up on this by kind of asking you a question. Might be a difficult question, and that is, are there areas of life or engagement or segments of theology that fit into Hispanic culture more normally or naturally that tend not to be addressed if it's a European or an Anglo-American who's addressing the theological topic? I mean, are there certain things where the Latino and Hispanic community have given attention to or have thought about certain issues in ways that everyone can learn from them? I mean, that's a really bad way to ask the question, but you get what I'm getting at.
Are you asking me?
Or? Yeah.
Yeah, I think one of the areas that stands out to me is the concern with society, poverty, the oppression, violence. Those are issues that come up often in the Hispanic setting, not just here in the U.S., but certainly in Latin America as well. And you keep in mind that when we have Hispanics migrating into our country, that's their background. That's what they bring with them. And so that's going to influence the way they see the world. And so in that setting, oftentimes they will have a theological perspective that might address those topics more than we would here in the U.S.
And are there writings in this regard? I'll be honest with you. Sometimes when I have these conversations, particularly with international students, they say, you aren't asking me to read anything that's written from the world I come out of. You know, that's kind of the way it's said. And they're right. Okay, it's not my world. I don't know. In some cases, I'm not even acquainted with the literature, that kind of thing. So, are there things that fit into that kind of a category that are of value to consider and even names of certain writers that might be of help to us?
I mean, there are some. Most of them are would of course come from Latin America. There are some folks like Samuel Escobar. There's another guy down in Argentina named Norberto Seraco, who have written on some of these topics. I know in some of my classes right now, I'm trying to introduce some of these Latin American theologians and authors so that our students here, even at DTS, can begin to be exposed to a broader scope of writers and thinkers when it comes to theology, especially when we're talking about cross-cultural issues.
Yvonne,
I can actually add a little bit on that. Yeah, yeah. I can say René Padilla,
Arnold
Segura. And in fact, right now, They're actually debating among themselves from the old generation of more of the integral mission, that's what they would call it, Misión Integral, to more of a revisitation because of current events that have occurred with, you know, the recent, the church in Colombia rejecting the deal with the FARC, as FARC, and
the peace agreement, right?
And so many other things where, you know, the church opposing abortion and many other things that where the church seems to be very socially involved, but really not having that theological foundation or the theological understanding of, you know, why they need to be doing those things. I mean, they have reached levels of, you know, political influence and so on, but, you know, culture in general is not being affected as they were hoping, you know, 20 years ago when the Misión Integral idea was started. So there is a whole dialogue and that aspect happening right now.
There's another layer of theological reflection that might be worth considering.
Okay.
And not just from the Latin America authors, but also from the Hispanic authors in the United States and that second, third generation of new theologians that's coming. Garcia Johnston in Princeton has some really good stuff. And also interdenominational traditional dialogue with the Catholic Church, because they have done extensive theological reflection on Latin America that Protestants would do well in considering just what they're coming from and their vantage points.
So. Interesting. I think it's, like I say, it's a whole area, generally speaking, that doesn't come up and doesn't get addressed very often. And certainly, I would say that the average Anglo, not just student, but even the average Anglo professor is not even aware of some of these conversations. And if you're going into the space, you got to go into the space. I mean, it's just that simple. We're rapidly running out of time here. So let me ask one more key question, and it goes like this. And you've alluded to some of this, but I'm going to give you time to develop it. What are some of the mistakes that are often made in reaching out to Hispanics and Latinos that should be avoided like the plague? So what do you think goes into that? And then what are some things that you think that are done well that seem to actually build the bridges that people are seeking to build? And Yvonne, I'll let you start since you.
Well, I'm going to speak from my experience, right. And so what I would say is, you know, oftentimes organizations, you know, are cautious of the opportunity, you know, but immediately they think, well, how much is this going to cost me, you know, and they assume that the cost will have to be absorbed by Anglo dollars. But in fact, what we're showing through our agency is that the Latino population is now at a point where they can actually contribute, you know, in a good way, and actually in a way that could make that initiative self-sustaining. And that's what we do through strategy, messaging, and campaign activations and so on. But that is then something that I think needs to be eliminated from the mindset, change the paradigm. There is an untapped opportunity there for good reasons, because Hispanics are enthusiastic about supporting causes, specifically religions, because it matters to them. And so I think that needs to be a consideration. What is done well? I think right now, slowly, the ministries are becoming more aware of, you know, the opportunity, and they're more open to the conversation. They're bringing people with experience, you know, to the table, either in a church or through an agency or in an education institution. So that's a good thing. And I continue to encourage all of us, as our job, really, to be the evangelists, right, to make the case for Hispanics.
Miguel?
I think some things to definitely avoid, like the plague, ethnocentrism, whether on the Anglo or the Hispanic side. There are Hispanics that only want to be the Mexican church or the Spanish-speaking church. That is absolutely untenable for the church. The church is the body of Christ, and ethnicity is welcome. So ethnocentrism, I mentioned paternalism earlier, and also just good intentions without counting the cost. A lot of churches want to start a Hispanic ministry just to find out. They don't have what it takes to plant a church, let alone a Hispanic church. So they need to count the cost. They need to do their homework, find out the best models they can get a hold on, and then start once they have counted the cost.
Michael?
Again, just not to presume too much about the Hispanic culture and really be willing to enter into it with an open eyes, open ears, and willing to dialogue about what they really are, where they are at, what their needs might be, and how you might be able to serve them if you want to serve them, and not presume, as even Miguel just alluded to, and I've mentioned it as well, that we are not monocultural. We're very diverse, and we need to be sensitive to that and be aware of that. I think what we're doing well, and I'm thinking again about the theological education setting right now, is that there are organizations and there are opportunities that we are moving forward with concerning how do we engage the Hispanic culture. I was just in Princeton for a conference there that had to do with biblical institutes and other seminaries that have Spanish programs, and really critically beginning to think through what is it that we can do to advance education and training and formation in the Hispanic culture and the Hispanic church. So there are some really positive things that are happening in that regard, and it's really an exciting time to be involved in Hispanic ministries.
Well, I want to thank you all for coming in and talking about this. You know, I think that one of the interesting things, and it's true of anyone who moves into a cross-cultural space, is to understand that the difference isn't necessarily a right or wrong category. Mm-hmm. It's just different. And mm-hmm. and becoming acquainted with it, becoming familiar with it, understanding that different people live their lives by different rules, and sometimes those rules are more a matter of choice and preference than they are a matter of right and wrong, actually helps you to develop an attitude that is willing to learn from another culture, that is willing to engage with another culture, that doesn't, you know, kind of keep them at a distance because of those differences, that kind of thing. And so I thank you for taking the time with us to help us think through what some of those differences are and how it works and how it can work for the church, because ultimately, as we have all said, the church is transnational. It is a body of Christ made up of many, many nations and many, many people, and we thank you for helping us understand that. And we thank you for being a part of the table where we discuss issues of God and culture, and we hope you'll be back again with us soon.
Thanks for listening to The Table Podcast. For more podcasts like this one, visit dts.edu/thetable. Dallas Theological Seminary. Teach truth, love well.